Welcome to Indie Media On Air. That was Bad Brains, and today we have a really good show for you. The first half we will spend with activists in D.C. preparing for the inauguration on Thursday, January 20th. And the second half of the show we'll be talking to Ado Bogado from KPFK, who just got back from Argentina. And we're going to be talking about what is going on in Argentina. And before we get into that, we're going to hear some couple of tracks that from Martin Luther King on his Vietnam speech from April 4th, 1967. We're going to go through two of those, and we're going to read some news from indie media. So why don't we go straight to MLK and on his birthday today.
As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent.
And this track regarding the press in that same speech.
America and most of its newspapers applauded me in Montgomery when I stood before thousands of Negroes getting ready to riot when my home was bombed, and said, "We can't do it this way." They applauded us in the sit-in movement, and we nonviolently decided to sit in at lunch counters. They applauded us on the freedom rides when we accepted blows without retaliation. They praised us in Albany and Birmingham and Selma, Alabama. Oh, the press was so noble in its applause and so noble in its praise when I was saying, be nonviolent toward Bull Connor. When I was saying, be nonviolent toward Jim Clark. There's something strangely inconsistent about a nation and a press that will praise you when you say, be nonviolent toward Jim Clark, but will curse and damn you when you say, be nonviolent toward little brown Vietnamese children. There's something wrong with that press.
Happy birthday, Martin Luther King. All right. Headlines from indiemedia.org. Amid claims of torture, USA plans indefinite detention camps. The Pentagon and the CIA have asked the White House to decide on a more permanent approach for potentially lifetime detentions, including for hundreds of people now in military and CIA custody whom the government does not have enough evidence to charge in courts. This comes after the International Red Cross made allegations of abuse, mistreatment, and torture by the USA. It alleges that U.S. interrogators not only used psychological and physical coercion, but also enlisted the participation of medical personnel in what the report called, quote, a flagrant violation of medical ethics. Doctors and involvement in torture has been raised most recently in the New England Journal of Medicine, January 6, 2005, which claims doctors aided in detainee abuse. For more on that story, please visit indiemedia.org. There are links to released records from the ACLU, by the ACLU, and other links on to Amnesty International and the Geneva Convention on Torture. And this from indiemedia.org via Brazil, the fifth international youth camp at the World Social Forum. During the World Social Forum of 2005, the fifth intercontinental youth camp, IYC, will take place in Parque Harmonia, Porto Alegre. Situated in the heart of the World Social Forum landscape, the camp will map the alternatives throughout the camp, focusing on self-management, horizontality, diversity, and creative resistance, experimenting and proposing alternatives that oppose capitalist and neoliberal hegemony. The youth camp opens its doors on the 24th of January to around 25,000 people from around the world. One challenge of the IYC 2005 is to enable the building of a new networks of different struggles seeking articulation from local to global levels with the capacity to influence the consequences and causes of global political spheres, and also it will be crucial to collect information on all the different practices experimented in the camp for exchange on an international level and spread the ideas. Our last story is from indymedia.us via the DC Indie Media website, dc.indymedia.org. The Inauguration Media Coalition is providing a media resource center with high-speed internet access and facilities for doing audio, video, print, photo, and web. The space will be open Saturday, January 15th to Friday, January 21st. It will be open every day from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. except on Inauguration Day, which will be open from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. The Media Resource Center is located at 624 T Street, Northwest Washington, D.C., at the intersection of T Street and 7th Street, near Shaw and Howard University, on the Green Line. During the inauguration of President Bush on January 20, 2005, the mainstream media will be buzzing with coverage of parties, parades, and speeches, costing the American people tens of thousands of dollars. The same mainstream media provided almost no coverage of the protests and general dissent surrounding the 2000 inauguration. The Inauguration Media Coalition has determined that independent messages are heard. And that leads right into our discussion with Selena Masuta. We're going to actually play a clip that she produced for Free Speech Radio News.
These are nods. We actually use these for night vision. We also, along with our PEQs, we're able to see if we send out an IR with this device, he can send out an IR dot that no one else can see.
28-year-old Sergeant Jeremy McClellan of the 1st and 3rd Delta Company demonstrates his semi-automatic gun in his night gear at the National Mall in front of reporters. McClellan is part of a special unit that will be deployed on Inauguration Day into the streets of D.C. if called upon. Secretary of Homeland Security Tom Ridge announced inauguration security details on Tuesday and said that more than 15 agencies will staff command centers throughout the Washington, D.C. area in order to prevent and deter what they consider potential acts of terrorism. Ridge gave a list of actions that law enforcement officials will take on the 20th. However, Ridge said there were many security details that would not be disclosed.
We'll have patrols in the harbor and surrounding waters providing security, led by the United States Coast Guard. We'll have mobile command vehicles positioned at strategic locations to coordinate communications across multiple law enforcement agencies. We will have 24/7 surveillance of key inaugural facilities, as well as portable X-ray equipment to examine packages, as well as commercial vehicles and delivery trucks entering these areas. In addition, we will deploy trained Homeland Security personnel to augment the work of local law enforcement. We anticipate there will be about 6,000 law enforcement personnel here from dozens of federal, state, and local agencies.
Chief Charles Ramsey of the Metropolitan Police Department, or MPD, is one of many law officials heading up security. Ramsey spearheaded one of the most controversial mass arrests in Washington, D.C., often referred to as the Pershing Park incident.
So there could possibly be a repeat of what happened at Pershing Park.
We work very hard to uphold the rights of all people during all demonstrations.
The Pershing Park incident happened on September 2002 during an anti-IMF and World Bank protest, where D.C. police unlawfully arrested 400 people inside the park without issuing a warning to disperse. A series of lawsuits are still pending over the 2002 mass arrest. The suit includes a class action lawsuit against the Metropolitan Police Department, or MPD, as well as an investigation led by the D.C. City Council. The suit also spurred a class action lawsuit against the Metropolitan Police Department, or MPD, as well as an investigation led by the D.C. City Council. In December, the City Council passed legislation to further protect the rights of protesters, including limiting the MPD's ability to order mass detentions. This legislation was sent on Monday to the mayor to pass or veto. Organizations that have been planning inauguration protests like ANSWER and United for Peace and Justice have spent much of their energy fighting to make the inauguration parade route more accessible to the public. Chioma Aru A longtime DC activist who supports the Inauguration Day protest believes, however, that the focus on the inauguration is diverting attention from the issues that will be bringing thousands to DC.
I understand that security is a big issue, and I understand that Tom Ridge and in cahoots with Anthony Williams are going to make life extremely difficult for people to express themselves passively or actively. That is a cause for those people who have taken it on, and I support. But I also know there are other grounds we need to be working on too.
Millions of dollars will be spent on security. Much of it will be paid for by D.C. taxpayers. ANSWER and the Muslim American Society plan to file on Thursday at a federal court to try to open Pennsylvania Avenue to the general public. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Selena Masuta.
And we are joined online with Selena. Selena, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Selena, you're with the D.C. Radio Co-op and Indie Media Inauguration Media Group.
Yes, I am.
That was a great report, and I want to follow up on some of that discussion. What is actually happening on the ground today?
Well, as many people will know, or do know, and you can actually get more information on dc.indiemedia.org or www.inaugurationmedia.org, there's been several street closures around the downtown area. These street closures are going to take effect, I'm pretty sure, on Wednesday and continue on Thursday. But you can double-check that on those sites as well. What's happening right now, some of the things that are kind of distressing, at least to me, are that people who are living in that area, or I would say homeless residents of D.C. who are living in that area are being told not to be in that area during that time. And there's some procedures that I'm actually looking into to find out more about what is happening in that situation. So I think that's something that people should be on the watch out for and find out more what's going to happen, or how the security measures and how the inauguration is going to be affecting D.C. residents, because a lot of the times people don't talk about D.C. residents. They talk about these protests. They talk about the events such as the balls, the inauguration balls that are going to be taking place, but they don't necessarily talk about what's going to happen with D.C. residents. Businesses are going to be closed. Residents are going to be affected by that. Taxi drivers are going to be affected by that, since many of them won't be able to go on their regular routes. These are really important things to recognize, especially since a lot of money that's going to be spent on this inauguration is going to be paid for by D.C. residents who don't have any representation in Congress.
And why is that?
Well, basically...
why are they having to pay for it?
Well, that's a good question. Since the Metropolitan Police Department will have to be used to deal with security issues, the federal government is saying that D.C. should pay for it. But not only D.C. is not only going to be paying for, the Metropolitan Police Department, the use of them in this situation, but they're also going to be paying for bleachers, which the bleachers that are going to be used for this inauguration, which is really incredible, since you have to pay $15 to $150 to even be able to sit on those bleachers. And I wonder how many people will be able to afford that. So it's very interesting. A lot of things that don't make any sense, in my opinion, are being paid by D.C. residents. And that's the case for a lot of things that happen in D.C. So this is not an unusual thing.
I mean, it's everything I've been reading about this inauguration, it's a virtual police state over there. And it's probably the largest security measures that have been taken for an inauguration. Isn't that right?
I would say definitely that is the case. From what Tom Ridge was saying, I went to the press conference as you were playing earlier. A lot of money is being put into securing the inauguration. But what I would say is that, even though people would say that D.C. is under a police state right now, D.C. has been under a police state ever since it's been D.C. So just the fact that we don't have representation in Congress. Actually, last month, the D.C. City Council passed a measure after a year of, after a year of investigations into the 2002 Pershing Park incident, where hundreds of protesters were rounded up and arrested for no reason during the IMF World Bank protest. There was an investigation that went on by the D.C. City Council, and what happened was that they passed a resolution to say that basically that the police are not allowed to make mass arrests, you know, just because, and they're not allowed to hold people indefinitely. They're not allowed to, what would you say, restrain people hand and foot. And that resolution has been passed on to Mayor Anthony Williams. He actually got it earlier this January, and he has not signed that resolution. Even if he did sign that resolution, which would really, I think, would guide the Metropolitan Police Department and at least give them, at least they would recognize that they needed to, even though they would recognize that they need to actually follow those measures, even if Mayor Anthony Williams does sign it, it still has to go to Congress. So it wouldn't even be put into law until Congress signed it, which I think is really ridiculous.
We are also joined on the line by Jay Marks. Jay Marks is a part of the D.C. Anti-War Network, or DAWN. Jay, are you with us?
Yes, Chris.
Why don't you tell us what DAWN is all about and what kind of activities are happening?
Sure. DAWN, the D.C. Anti-War Network, basically came into being a couple of years ago after the September 11th catastrophe and has been fighting against the U.S. militarism and imperialism ever since, but first in Afghanistan and then, of course, in Iraq. And so DAWN has done a lot of demonstrations since these last couple of years, and we're really excited about what's going on this week. DAWN's affiliated with United for Peace and Justice. We've done a number of events up in New York, running buses so local D.C. activists can get involved up in New York as well. And so some folks are coming down from New York and from all over the country. We're going to do a rally and march, rally at Malcolm X Park, which is kind of in the heart of D.C., and then marching right down 16th Street to the, as close as we can get, really, to the parade route. And then, of course, there's, as you were talking about, the incredible police presence and the kind of over-the-top security measures that I guess you can understand when you have a highly unpopular president who is, you know, doubted by many of the people. I guess this is what you do. If you go against democracy, you have to really spend a lot of money on security in order to have the president have his ceremony. But so we're going to march down. We've got, you know, a lot of great speakers. We're excited about a huge lineup, including Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! Is going to speak. We're excited about that. And our keynote speaker is actually a Haitian activist, Father Jean Just, who is flying in to tell us a little bit about, American imperialism is in so many places, but also in Haiti, where, of course, the democratically elected president there, Father Jean-Bertrand Aristide, was for the second time evicted, basically, in a coup.
We may have lost Jay. Selena, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm still here.
I have a question, and maybe Jay can answer this when he gets back, and I'll direct it to both of you. Why is this demonstration important? I mean, given that the elections were, it seems, again, were once stolen, people are forced still to choose between two factions of a business party. Why is this important for people to come out?
Well, it's actually funny to ask me that, because I don't know necessarily whether this demonstration is that important, which may seem odd since I'm doing a lot of work around inauguration media events. And the main reason why I'm involved with it, and I hope, you know, it's a reason that people think of when they do come down to D.C., and even if you don't come down to D.C., I hope this is something that we all think about, that there's a need to continue a dialogue. There's a need to frame these issues in different ways. They're not framed by, you know, the government. That's not framed by the media. That's not framed by, you know, nonprofits. But it's framed by, you know, our neighbors and the people that are having very much complex issues or complex thoughts, that, you know, we need to be pushing each other in terms of how we think about our, you know, the state of this country, as well as how this country was built and how this country continues to position itself in this world. I think that's really important. What we're trying to do at the inauguration, with the Inauguration Media Group, our foremost mission is to facilitate a creation of independent, non-corporate media at the 2005 inauguration, but also it's important for us to train people on how to do media, how to be media, how to, you know, continue that dialogue, how to be able to find new ways of thinking about these situations. So that's why I think this demonstration is important. Not necessarily that the demonstration is important, but how we use this demonstration to continue to do the work that is needed to address the issues that we find important in our lives.
And that was my follow-up question. I mean, so many of these mass demonstrations get people to come out and I've been at them, and the most important thing that I've taken away is actually meeting people and continuing those relationships, those networks of organizing. But it's so disempowering at some point. How many times are we going to go out and get together in these mass demonstrations and come away feeling totally disempowered? What about, you know, what are the strategies for the coming years and you know, the bigger questions of what we really need to work on? And maybe, Jay, you can address that.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Chris, sorry about that, getting cut off. I guess they didn't like me talking bad about the U.S. government with regard to Haiti. But it's such a key question. On a personal level, what I would love to see, there's a progressive divide in the U.S. that I'd love to see healed. Progressive Democrats and then progressive independents, Greens, socialists, right, the anarchists, the whole nine yards. What we share is a common agenda, but we're divided by our basically divided by these really imaginary lines of party. And once we can see through the party BS and get to the truth of the matter, which we actually agree on far more than we disagree about, we just disagree about how we should go about pursuing our agenda. And so one of the things that I'm excited about with the lineup of speakers that we've got and with folks coming together at this demonstration is hopefully, I mean, more and more people who are Democrats are disenchanted and realizing that the Democratic Party leadership doesn't really represent the Democratic Party membership anymore. And I think people are realizing that we have to, you know, look elsewhere. And I think what we're doing is putting forth progressive leaders who I think understand that and can kind of point a way forward. And like Sister was saying, it's so critical that we do that and that we come away from this demonstration. I think this demonstration is going to be really exciting and empowering because I think there are so many people who just know that this president is bad for the country, bad for the planet. And, you know, we're not ashamed to say it. We're not afraid to say it. And I think a lot of people are really excited to get out there and demonstrate it in a colorful, exciting, cultural way. And again, that's probably the best thing we can do is get out there. We're going to have a lot of music at these demonstrations, both up at Malcolm X Park and then down near the march route at McPherson Square. We're going to have a stage with a lot of local and some quasi-national musical acts. And in the end, I think culture is one of the best ways to do it. I've been joking with friends about how, you know, Bush is costing us so much in national treasure and in our national reputation, that the very least we can do is take it out on him and get our money's worth in fun, entertainment, and making fun of this, you know, god-awful administration for the next 4 years, and especially on Thursday.
Selena, you in your interview, you interviewed a woman who said that she had some issues with the big protest and the demonstration. And about a month ago, we did an interview with Rahul Mahajan, who made a comment about these getting away from these mass demonstrations and start looking at different strategies and tactics for, you know, challenging the war and many other things. What are some of your ideas about how people might do that?
Man, I wish I totally knew. I know that, like, for me, I don't like mass mobilizations, personally. Not speaking as a member of, you know, the Inauguration Media Group, but I think in many ways they are disempowering. And I do think, I mean, unlike Jay, I do think that that there are but these imaginary lines are not imaginary. There are real issues within what people want to call the left, and we're not dealing with it. The many people that are going to be coming to these mobilizations are mostly white, and they mostly come from certain class backgrounds. And yes, you know, there is a little bit of diversity there, but there's a reason why people are not coming out, and there's a reason why there's a protest culture, and there's a problem when we have a protest culture. And I think that's what a lot of people are feeling, disillusioned, including the woman that I spoke to, Chioma. The issue is that there's a lot of things that we're working on, and part of it is like really looking internally at what is wrong and how we frame these issues and how we do our outreach, because how we do our outreach is as much important as who we as the actual events that we organize for. Because let's say, you know, we have this mass mobilization and thousands of people come out, and yeah, that's great, and people chant and they sing and they feel good, and yeah, they make their connections. But people have such a short-term memory here that it's just going to be a continuation, in my opinion, of mass mobilizations that don't really empower a lot of people of doing things. And, you know, I live in my block, right? Many of the people that live on my block don't like Bush, and they are older black folks, younger black folks. I live in a mostly Democratic city. I live in a mostly city of color. And most of the people that live in the city are not going to go to those mobilizations. Even though they hate Bush, even though they hate the Democratic Party, they have no faith in them. The reason why they're not going to is because it doesn't reach out to them. They don't feel as if their issues are being addressed. They don't feel empowered to do much, because the thing is, people are trying to survive. The issue that we have to deal with in D.C. is gentrification. We have to deal with the fact that this city is becoming whiter and whiter, more upper class every day, and people are not able to afford to live in their neighborhoods. They're not being able to afford food. And those are real problems that exist. And yeah, it's connected to Bush, but it's connected to a systematic problem. We have a systematic problem, and getting Bush out of office is not going to address that systematic problem. And even if Kerry was in office, I still wouldn't have health insurance, just like many people that I know who are working in media issues that I deal with every day.
Listen, I want to thank you both for joining us on Indie Media On Air, and I want to give out websites one more time. If you don't mind, please do that for me, because I don't have it in front of me.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, no, sure. For the counter-inaugural, counter-inaugural.org.
Okay.
And www.dawndc.net.
Great. Selena?
You can go on www.inaugurationmedia.org to get more information about the space that anybody could come to. Please do. And also go on dc.indiemedia.org. There's going to be a live internet radio stream. Please tune in. Listen to the concerns of D.C. residents. Listen to the concerns of people coming into the city.
Thank you very much for joining us today on Indie Media On Air. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with Otto Bogato.
Listening to Indie Media On Air on community-based KPFK. Tomorrow from 7 to 9 p.m., you can hear a special on A History of Zionism, a perspective which can serve as a useful tool for better understanding of the current political stalemate in Israel-Palestine. That's tomorrow night from 7 to 9. Coming up at 4 is the voices from the frontline edition of the 4 o'clock report.
Weekday afternoons here on KPFK.
What's up? My name's Jerry Quigley. This is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles.
That's right. It's getting crazy up in here. Welcome to the show. I'm Michael Slate.
Welcome to the 4 o'clock report. I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on 90.7 KPFK.
And you're listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK. For all of Southern California, I'm Susie Wiseman.
You can hear KPFK's Evening Public Affairs Block all week long, Monday through Friday.
Is the war in Iraq becoming in actuality a nuclear war. Yes, nuclear with a big N.
But it actually is very important in terms of what's going on with the Arab and Muslim peoples in the States, where they're being rounded up simply for their nationality or their religious beliefs.
That's weekdays from 4 to 6 in the evening here on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and at kpfk.org for the world.
I'll be right here 5 o'clock tomorrow. You know how we do. Peace, peace, peace.
We are back on InniMedia On Air, and we are joined by Ada Bogado. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I'm really happy to have you here to talk about Argentina. And I think it would be very helpful to start off with a very simple background of what happened in 2001 for people. And then we can talk about some of the events since then and the organizations.
Yeah. Actually, let's talk about 2001, but in a not so linear way. I should probably start off by saying that my motivations for taking this trip started out largely personal. I was born and raised in Argentina. I came to the United States when I was 6, and I hadn't been back since I was a teenager. And about 6 months ago, my brother was executed by a police officer. And so this trip really started out about going back and really dealing with that and trying to heal from that and spending time with my family. At the same time, it was about really investigating the conditions under which so many young people could be killed in a country that are either political organizers or that come from political families such as my own. And what I found was, the state is definitely needing to repress people because of the mass amount of social movements that are going on there. I left for Argentina on the 17th of December, I believe, and so I was there for the anniversary of what happened in 2001, the economic and political collapse. So on the 20th of December, which was a couple days after I got there, I went to the capital, Buenos Aires, to Plaza de Mayo, and saw an incredible amount of movement, hundreds of thousands of people. It really didn't matter what street I looked down. There were people everywhere, organized by all the different types of groups, whether independent media groups, unions, by neighborhood, by factories, what have you. And that was really, for some people, it was kind of commemorating this anniversary of this collapse, which you referred to a minute ago, which was what happened in 2001, which was the failure of this neoliberal economic model, which Argentina had really bought into for a while, particularly for that last decade, for the 90s, in which you saw mass privatization. Everything in Argentina is privatized. Transportation, education is not, and luckily, and healthcare is not, but practically everything else is. You won't walk down a street in the capital without seeing the name of the street and the company that sponsors that street on the sign. And so for a lot of people, it was a way to kind of commemorate that, because for a lot of people, that was the first time that they were out on the street. We have to remember that Argentina lived under a dictatorship from 76 to 83, which is, the reason that I'm here. A lot of people had to leave, and a lot of people, 30,000 people, were disappeared, which is a euphemism for they were murdered because of their political activities. And so a lot of people came out in 2001 because they realized that what they were living under would no longer work.
I want to give you my sincerest condolences on air for your brother and your family.
Thank you.
It's so heavy. And the reaction of people down there was amazing. They not only did they take to the streets, but when the owners of these factories and businesses just turned their backs on people, people said no. And they took back these factories. They took back these workplaces. They people started organizing in new ways without, collectivizing these businesses. making them profitable and paying themselves, not to mention the support in the communities, the families, and from housing, you know, to book publishing, to aluminum factories. You were just there and you saw that.
Yeah, the degree of solidarity and that I witnessed in Argentina is it's nearly indescribable, and the easiness with which people approach their neighbors, and it's just expected that if there's a struggle going on, you're of course going to support your neighbor, you're going to support your compañeros. There are so many examples. One example is this amazing book printing place called Chilavert, which is in the capital. And Chilavert was originally owned by this man, you know, who was really into books, etc. I believe in the 20s is when it started, and he had this factory for quite a long time. It's not a factory exactly; it's a bookmaking place from beginning to end. They print all the materials there, they sew them, they do the covers, everything. And his son inherited the place, and his son was not a very nice person, and decided that he was going to close the doors, but not tell the workers. He had 8 workers. He didn't inform any of them. And what he did do was go to a neighbor and say, hey, will you help me sell some of this equipment? And the neighbor got hip to what was going on and realized that, oh, he's going to sell the equipment and not replace it. He must be closing the doors. So the neighbor could have, you know, made some commission on selling these machines. What he did instead was he went to the workers and said, you know, this guy's going to close the door on you, and he's probably not going to pay you, and you're not going to have a place to work, most importantly. And so they did a lot of organizing for a really long time. And again, that level of organizing and that level of talking to your neighbor and letting people know what's going to go on and then asking them for support is just really this everyday phenomena. And so what happened was the workers decided to take it. They decided to take this bookmaking, this book press, Chilavert, and so they barricaded themselves inside, and they were supported by a massive amount of unemployed workers groups, other unions, other people who had taken factories, which they were taking some example from, and then just neighbors, people from the community. And so while they had, you know, cops outside 24 hours a day and an ambulance and a fire truck, because obviously these altercations tend to be very violent when police do try to get into a place that the workers are trying to take. And they just had a massive amount of support from the community. And I was there with a friend, and we were in kind of where the administration is, which is a really interesting point, because Chilavert, they decided not to hire anybody from outside. They realized that their own knowledge as workers could instruct them as to how to run something that they already knew how all the ways to run the press, and they needed to learn some bookkeeping, they needed to learn some things about the law, et cetera, and they decided that they were going to do it all themselves instead of, you know, just thinking that it's going to be better from outside. And they took a book order while they were trying to take the factory, while they were barricaded inside, and they needed to get the order out because the order was due, and they had no way to do it. And their neighbor next door coordinated with them, and what they did was they drilled a huge hole in the wall, and they had these boxes of books, and they just one by one just sent these boxes of books to their neighbor. And then another compañero, another neighbor from the neighborhood who was a plumber, and so he had a truck because a lot of people don't have their own transportation, went in there and took the entire order and delivered it, and they were able to show, look, we can do this. The cops had no idea. The cops were out there the whole time trying to get inside and trying to, you know, repress what these people struggle. And, you know, that's just one of many examples of the creativity and just you know, just the way in which people are really creative when it really comes down to it.
I want to remind listeners, I'm speaking with Ada Bogado from KPFK, KPFK host and producer. Ada hosts the show Radioactive every other Tuesday at 4 p.m., which you can hear tomorrow on KPFK 90.7 in Los Angeles and 98.7 in Santa Barbara. So people are finding creative ways to take back, expropriate the capital, which exploited them for years. And they've gotten a lot of support from some of the organizations in the community. Can you talk about a couple of those organizations?
There are a lot of organizations. A lot of times people have to learn, you know, from people who have already taken factories. And I don't want to romanticize it at all, because there are a lot of factories that have hired people from outside or that have just reproduced a hierarchical model within their own cooperative.
About 200 in all, correct?
Yes, there's 200 taken factories, and it's not just factories. For example, there's a place called El Tigre, which is a supermarket, and it's now called Cooperativa de Trabajadores en Lucha, which means cooperative of workers in struggles. So now if I want to go to the supermarket, I can say, I'm going to go to the cooperative of workers in struggle. And that's in Rosario, which is the second biggest city in Argentina. I didn't get a chance to go there, but I did talk to a compañera from there who is one of the organizers, and she runs a Centro Cultural, a cultural center. And this is something that we saw a lot of the factories, a lot of these places that have been taken back feel this need to reciprocate that solidarity to the community. And so what they do is they create a space, which is a cultural center. And in that space, they have anything you can think of, jewelry making, singing classes, guitar, printmaking, and really trying to go against this notion that, you know, you're only a worker or you're only an artist and you can't have time for both, and really trying to meld those two, as well as create a space in which the community can come in, which kids can come in and learn things. And it's really amazing. I forget your question, but I think it had something to do with
just a couple of the organizations that, you know, are working side by side, because they're not all worker organizations. There's there's Hijos.
Okay, yeah. Hijos is, I should probably get into the history a little bit of that. A lot of listeners may be familiar with Madres de Plaza de Mayo, which are the mothers of the 30,000 people that were disappeared and more, many more that were detained and tortured during the dictatorship. And what a lot of these people that were disappeared left behind were children. They left behind a lot of orphans, not only in Argentina, but throughout the world. And so Hijos, which means children, so they're the children of the disappeared, started organizing in 1995, really as a way to identify themselves and say, wow, there's other people like me. There's other people whose parents are fallen revolutionaries. The dictatorship came down in 83, but it really took a while for these children to figure out that, you know, they had this identity. And so from how I understand it, for a long time, it was really somewhat psychological, and really just saying, you know, there's a lot of us. And what they started doing was a lot of research and finding out who the repressors were during the dictatorship, and finding where they lived, finding their phone number, finding where they worked, finding their address, and going and doing what's called escraches, which is going to where this one of the members of the military junta lived, and calling them out, throwing paint, throwing small bombs if necessary, and really calling them out and letting the whole neighborhood know, you live next to a genocidal maniac, and really embarrassing those people because the law isn't doing it. At the same time, it's interesting because a lot of these hijos, their grandmothers are madres, right? Because they're the mothers of the disappeared, and you find a lot of co-option. The Kirchner government, the current president, has been somewhat successful at really co-opting a lot of people, the madres in particular. He lifted the amnesty laws. So technically, people who committed these heinous crimes during the dictatorship can technically be charged now. However, they haven't been charged. And so for people like Hijos, and for a large part of Argentinian society, it's a lot of words, and that's nice, but there's really no action. And so it's just this notion again of like, well, I'm going to take this into my own hands. I'm going to call this person out. This person murdered my parents or murdered my compañero's parents, and so I'm going to let everybody know and embarrass him into not living in this neighborhood anymore.
Now, all this is happening in the context of neoliberal reform that happened, as you described earlier, directly related to the IMF and World Bank policies of, you know, sort of a debt model in which they force these policies on Argentina. And it's clearly failed. I mean, it failed the country and the people, and now people are trying to take back what, you know, probably was in so many ways basically stolen, you know, from them and their resources. And there's been a huge international response to support a lot of these organizations. And one example is the Motorcycle Union. Maybe talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, the Motoquistas was – I was really odd just left and right wherever I went. It was just hard to concentrate on one thing because, like I said, there's so much action just walking down the street. On the 20th of December of this year when I went to that huge march, you would just see a lot of people. I was on a really huge avenue called Nueve de Julio, which is this gigantic avenue. And you just saw all kinds of people just gathering there. And I knew that we were going to get to Plaza de Mayo. I wasn't sure how. There's a lot of ways to get there. And I started seeing more and more motorcyclists, which are called motoquistas out there. And I started seeing more and more and more of them to the point where I started seeing thousands of them kind of rounding up. And then they started splitting up in groups of about 100, 200, 300, 400, and just going out in mass and just stopping traffic. They would just be like, okay, we're going to take this street and we're going to take it. And they would just, you know, if you're a taxi driver, if you happen to have a car and you're driving in the capital, all of a sudden, you know, there's 200 motorcyclists are coming at you. So you're basically going to stop. And so they're responsible. They're really like this front line. There are many other things too, but just in terms of marches, they're really this front line in terms of like clearing the way for people to be able to march into where they need to go. They also serve as security because, like I said, there is a mass amount of state repression. People are severely beaten. People are often killed. And so what they do is when they see the police trying to repress somebody, they take care of it, whether they need to, do a self-defense action against the police or simply pick up a compañero that's, you know, being beaten by the police. That's what they do. The motoquistas at the same time, there's 50,000 motoquistas in Buenos Aires. And they really run the city because the banks are unable to function without the motoquistas. It's hard to drive a car in the city. I mean, it's literally hard because there's a lot of traffic. And so what the motoquistas do is they do a lot of just mass delivery, and it's in within that financial sector. And so the banks know that if the motoquistas aren't around, then, you know, they can't function. And this union that's formed, the Motoquistas Union that's formed, they're basically anarcho-syndicalists. And they tried to get state recognition for their union because they work, you know, 6 days a week, sometimes 10, 12, 14, up to 16 hours. They work ridiculous hours. It's very dangerous. They have to pay for their own insurance. They only get to keep half of each delivery, and it's really grueling work. And so they tried to form a union in order to better their working conditions, and the state wouldn't recognize them. So what wound up happening was they were like, "Fine, we don't really need your recognition. We're gonna do this anyway." And what you're seeing now is similar motorcycle unions in Europe, which are showing their support. For example, in just a few months, in Spain, the motorcyclist union in Spain is going to take a day off. They're going to strike, just do a general motorcycle strike in Spain. And as many motorcyclists as possible are going to drive their motorcycles to the Argentine embassy saying, Hello, we're motorcyclists, and in solidarity with our brothers and sisters that are motorcyclists in Argentina, we demand that the state recognize them and give them what they want. So I think that that's really amazing, and I think that that's really where we need to start taking example from in terms of internationalism.
There's a lot to learn from Argentina.
Definitely, definitely.
There are factories, in fact, that need spare parts, and I know there's efforts. I saw a site, workerswithoutbosses.net, which actually is calling for people to find spare parts for different factories that need them so workers can keep working in them. On so many levels, what's happening here, even after the discussion we just had about what's happening in D.C. and tactics and strategy, there's so much to learn from Argentina. Maybe you can comment on a couple of those ideas. And also maybe what can people do here to support what's going on there?
Yeah, that's I'm not really sure yet. You know, I just recently got back. I know that it's interesting because here my identity is, you know, I'm a woman of color. I'm an immigrant here. I'm all these things here. When I was in Argentina and this was really hard for me, I have a great amount of privilege as soon as I start speaking in English. Otherwise, I'm just kind of, you know, I'm from Argentina. But as soon as I start speaking in English, it's just this great amount of privilege and people really start looking at you different in all kinds of different ways as a Yankee, which is kind of a Yankee, right? Somebody that comes from the north and just sucks everything that's there. Or, it was really a struggle for me to sort of deal with that. So it's hard. I'm not really sure how to answer that question right now. But I think that we need to start looking, at least one way, looking at the way in which we provide solidarity. Is solidarity just sending some money? Is solidarity just going there and you know, taking a poverty tour? Probably not. It's probably a lot more. I think that the motorcyclist union example in Spain is really inspiring. And again, I'm not really sure how to answer that question, but really trying to, and it's really impossible in a way, but really trying to remove ourselves from this first world romantic anthropological perspective. And, you know, maybe it does require spending some time there and really figuring out and asking these compañeros, what do you need? A lot of people will inevitably tell you. I mean, it was really hard for me because I had a lot of people, you know, a couple of people very specifically saying, what are you doing with your life? Will you come and struggle with us? And that's really deep. I think there's a lot of ways, but I think that some of that, you know, before we answer that question, I think it's looking at the way we look at the world.
One thing I want to understand is, for people here, for myself, who are involved in creating, you know, different types of institutions, there's a level of consciousness that was on the ground there already that prepared people to act in this manner and take action the way they did. What was there? There's a cultural aspect of it. You know, maybe it doesn't exist here. Maybe it does. Maybe we have to find it.
Yeah, I think that there is a cultural aspect. Some people might be familiar with the fact that in Argentina we drink this thing called mate, which is a tea, and it's passed around in a circle, and everyone kind of partakes in it. And I just grew up drinking it. But I really, when I was there, someone just pointed out to me how that is something that really just sort of binds people together. And I mean, you know, when you meet somebody, whether it's a man or a woman, it doesn't matter. You give somebody a kiss on the cheek or two. You have to. If you go to shake someone's hand, that means you probably have a problem. So there's a general degree of just warmth that really doesn't exist here for the most part in the United States. It does, you know, somewhat in my community where I live, but not to that degree. I actually forget the question. What did you just ask?
No, that's it. It's the context that you know creates the ability for people to come together like this.
I also think that there's a mass need. There's a mass need. We're not experiencing that need economically right now at all, for better or for worse. But nevertheless, I mean, the euro's coming, China's coming. I don't think the United States is that far off in certain ways, and I think that we do have a lot of lessons to learn from Argentina.
I think we're about to wrap it up here, and I want to thank you so much for joining us on the show today, and hopefully we can continue this discussion and learn more. Where should people read up on what's happening?
That's a good question. I don't have any websites on hand. I unfortunately didn't get to talk about Grupo Alavio. But if you try to do a Google search for them, they're a really good resource. I have always seen really good articles on ZNet, always. If you look for a writer named Marie Trigona, she's actually a U.S.-American journalist that moved to Argentina a few years ago and is not coming back. Otherwise, I don't really have anything else on hand, particularly in English.
Thank you very much, Ada.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
I want to thank our engineer, Molly White, our producer, Alan Minsky, our guest, Jay Marks, Selena Masuda, and Ada Bogado. Stay tuned, and we'll be back next week with more of Indie Media On Air.
Been listening to Indie Media On Air, heard Mondays from 3 to 4 in the afternoon on community-based KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and at kpfk.org for the world. The Voices from the Frontline edition of the 4 o'clock reports is coming up next. Stay tuned to hear more progressive, independent radio. There's more to this than just a kiss.